Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about scaling D&D adventures on the fly for different numbers of players, and whether it's more or less players than you expected, it is one of the most challenging issues for a DM to handle it. So we'll walk you through the best options today, all that and more on Wandering DMs.
Hey everyone, before we get going into today's topic, I want to remind you that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat with Dan and I and everyone on our private Discord server, which you can join. How do you join the private Discord server? It's very easy. Just become a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that going over the course of the show, because at about 10 after 2 Eastern time, Dan and I will be starting up that after-party chat, and we'd love to see you there.
One of our favorite parts of the week. We just have the best patrons, and thanks to Vacuous for checking in on our various channels on Twitch and YouTube that we're currently going out live here this Sunday afternoon. So good to see everybody as always. And I'll point out that this conversation today is a bit of a callback to the episode, the chat that we had 3 weeks ago, Paul, on best party size. And we were talking about what is the best party size. You know, a lot of D&D editions kind of revolve around 4 or 5 or 6. As old schoolers, some of us tend to go a little bit larger than that. Myself, I actually like 7 or more. And then right at the end, we have the question, well, what do you do if you've prepped an adventure for a certain number of players and a different number show up? And we said, well, we certainly don't have time to dig into that right now. So this is, you are currently experiencing the time that we have for that right now.
Yeah, we you know, we wanted to go straight into this, actually. At the end of that show, it sounded like a great topic for follow-up. But, of course, we had some amazing guests, right? We had Luke Gygax join us and Matt Finch join us. So, like, we had to put it on the back burner for a little bit, but I'm glad we're getting back to it. You know, I think this is, honestly, for me, this is almost a bigger problem in campaign play than one-shots or conventions. Sure, it's a little variable in conventions just how many people are going to show up, but you kind of usually know the range. Hey, there's Matt Finch, speak of the devil. How are you, buddy? but with campaign play, right, when you're playing with the same group over and over, like, things happen, life happens, somebody gets sick, you know, somebody has a vacation, something weird happens, and for some reason this always happens, right? They all collide on the same day, and suddenly your 8-person game only has 3 people show up. What do? You still run?
Totally. Now, here's a point I will say. So we had a little discussion of that since the last chat about this on our Discord server, of course. And my take on larger versus smaller party sizes is that, in my experience with kind of tournament type stuff, larger party sizes, larger player groups have a little bit more trouble communicating and kind of wind up stumbling over each other's feet. Whereas smaller groups tend to be a lot more streamlined in their communications and seem to have very clear command control and kind of cut through the challenges surprisingly more easily than I personally would have expected. So on the one hand, maybe, Paul, maybe this is a self-correcting problem. Maybe if fewer players show up, they actually play more proficiently and they have a better time of getting through the challenges. And perhaps if you have more players, on the one hand, there's more bodies, but maybe they actually have more trouble coordinating. So possibly it's a self-correcting problem. But I will say that not all of our patrons agreed with that. And for example, one of our great friends, Seeker, said that his experience is the opposite, that with more numbers, it's more likely someone has the perfect spell to solve a problem, or there's just more brains available to come up with the right answer to a puzzle or something like that. So not everybody has the same experience that I do. And so I guess maybe we can't hang our hat on the self-correcting problem issue, which I kind of would have liked. So
You know, I think it depends on the kind of problems that they're solving, right? The kind of challenges that they're facing. I think it's very different when you're talking about a combat encounter from, say, solving a puzzle or doing an NPC interaction or creating a larger scale plan, right? Like, and that, again, very much a campaign issue, right? Where maybe the confluence of events are coming together and the players suddenly realize, oh, we have to decide who to ally with or what is our next step or what, you know, how do we progress this much larger plot issue that's been going on for weeks or months of the campaign, and now we have to like figure out how we as a group react to that. And it's interesting too, right? I think you're like both extremes hurt this, right? Yes, lots of bodies at the table. Suddenly you get into analysis paralysis. There's everybody's debating what's to do next, and a smaller group maybe can execute faster. But you go to the opposite extreme, you know, all the way down to say one person. You got one player at the table. They have no one to bounce ideas with. Right, they need, I think, that extra input to push themselves to, or to think in directions that they wouldn't naturally be inclined to think.
So, yeah, you know, I had an experience just last week, actually, in which the player group as a whole had this long range plan. Without getting the specifics of it, had a long range plan, and then we had a week where a number of people didn't show up, had a smaller player group. And there was a particular resource, there was a particular MacGuffin that the party had, and the smaller group went off track on what the larger plan had been, and they wound up expending this irretrievable resource for a completely different purpose than they had agreed on 2 weeks prior. And so the session after that, when the full play group did show up, I kind of did a little recap of what just happened, and the two people that hadn't been there for 1 week were shocked. We're shocked, like, you got rid of the X? You got rid of the egg that we can't get back? Really? But we were going to do this with it. We had this whole plan with it. Why did you do that? And there was kind of this interest, and I think maybe if the larger group had been there, they probably would have reminded them and maybe stuck with the original plan more. But because of the small group, it kind of floated. Or maybe I'm just a nasty DM and I tricked them. That's a distinct possibility. What actually happened there, Paul? But it would have been
the funny thing is that we're kind of swerving here into a tangent about absenteeism. But I think like one of the interesting things that I've seen happen in this case is it also depends on who's absent, right? Because sometimes the group will come up with a plan where like maybe two or three or four people are like, oh, we love this idea, but somebody who's the voice of reason is like, no, we shouldn't do that. There's a lot of good reasons we shouldn't do that. And that person's absent the next week. Guess what happens? Everything is, oh, great. That's not here. Forget it. We're gonna do the crazy thing.
That's sort of what happened. That's pretty much a good description of what just happened for me.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've good seen point. That. Yeah, sure. Okay, let's take a step back here. Let's boil this down to, I think, what is the simplest case of adapting or scaling to player group size. Because one of the things I was curious about not only is like, I want to talk not only about like just, you know, tips and tricks that you and I have come up with for how to deal with this, but also like looking at just written material. How does the written material advise us to move forward here, right? I think the most common case of this we see is the simplest case is combat, right? You've got an encounter with six goblins, and how do you adapt that for two players or 8 players or 25 players, right? And I think a lot of places I've seen this, you know, it's very easy to boil that down to a math problem, right? And I feel like I've seen this text, and you probably are going to tell me that you've got it somewhere for me to put on screen, where it just says, like, well, just math it out, right? If six goblins are there for a player of six, you know, a group of six, it's one goblin per player. So just, you know, extrapolate. If you have 3 players, only 3 goblins. If you have 8 players, 8 goblins. There you go.
I think that it's interesting that the earliest edition, the very original D&D, again, 50 years ago this year, explicitly said that that's fundamentally, in fact, it doesn't give any way of numbering monsters except for that, surprisingly, in the dungeon, right? Yep. And that's actually baked in the earliest rules. And then pretty quickly, within a year or two, they got away from that and were starting to give specific fixed ranges. So I do want to look at that earliest text. So if you can pull up the and you're going to see some text here. I apologize as we do on Wandering DMs.
Fans become so sensitive to my criticism of like they can't read the tiny text, man. Every time we put tiny text on the screen, they can't read it. The podcast listeners don't see it. Okay. Yes, we're gonna put text up. That's fine.
Oh, I'm a sensitive guy. You know me. I'm an emotional sensitive guy. Don't laugh that hard. Come on.
Okay. I'm assuming we're looking at the red dot here.
Yeah. So this is from original D&D, and the slice at the top is from the players volume one, which remind us that the number of players was somewhere between 4 and 50. for a campaign, I guess I said. But somewhat more interestingly, if you go into the DM's book, which is volume three of that early white box set, here's what you get. That you get some encounter tables that tell you what monster you've run into on a particular level. Great. And then here's the section that we've been grappling with for years. That's the number of wandering monsters appearing. And it says if the level beneath the surface roughly corresponds with the level of the monster, because every monster has a level here, then the number of monsters will be based on a single creature. Modified by type. So I guess orcs might be more numerous, something like that. And the number of adventurers in the party. So for example, a party from 1 to 3 would draw the basic number of monsters, which I believe is 1 that they just said. A player party from 4 to 6 would bring twice as many, which I guess would be 2 monsters, and so on and so forth. And then there's a couple of examples here that go off in different directions. So, you know, I've been grappling with that for years, but it sounds like, you know, that second class there of maybe you've got 4 to 6 players, which is, I think, what most of us assume for a ballpark estimate nowadays, would normally bring, if you're on the third level of the dungeon, would bring two third level monsters. Or you might consider like rolling a D3. Like that's what I tend to do for that.
That's interesting. So is it basically number of players divided by 3 is what they're telling you? Yeah, that's interesting.
Something like that. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now that's wandering monsters. It actually doesn't say at all what you should do for a set encounter. I personally suggest like just doubling that number. So then it's approximately the same as the player size. Some people suggest you should use the in lair numbers, but that's for the wilderness only. It explicitly says that, so that's not really appropriate. You're kind of at sea. You're really kind of at sea about the number of monsters. But if you have, you know, if you have 4 or 5 or 6 and you have a set encounter, I suppose you could just roll a D6 and you'd have about the right number, frankly. But anyway, the point here is it explicitly says the number of monsters is totally a function of the number of players. If you go forward to like the home's basic rules, that's still in there. Additions after that kind of, you know, get away from it. Let's actually, and I think the home's edition is really interesting. So if you could pull up the orange dot there, because Eric Holmes, who is clearly trying to clean up the original D&D rules here, and this is the set that I personally got started with myself, goes ahead and justifies it, right? Gives a reason for this. And the text says, the number of wandering monsters appearing, this is at the top of what we're looking at here, the number of wandering monsters appearing should be roughly equal to the strength of the party encountering them. So you get some numbers here. However, if the party was on the second level, then all the numbers would double. And what's highlighted here is the justification. It says, if justification is needed, simply consider that a small party is relatively quiet, thus attracting less attention than a large group. And also powerful characters will similarly bring more numbers of monsters. So I was never 100% comfortable with this, but it's still in Holmes. He's also seems to have beefed the numbers up a lot more. If original D&D seems to suggest that you start off with just 2 monsters, and then here they're saying, well, right off the bat, you're going to have 2 to 6 orcs or 3 to 12 giant rats, which are much larger numbers, but they still expect to scale it. So that's part of the core rules from the outset.
Interesting. You know, where my head always goes with this stuff is actually my favorite ever dungeon crawling board game, Warhammer Quest, which some folks might know is the the descendant of the much beloved HeroQuest. Both of those games were made for exactly four players. And it's a very classic dungeon crawl game. You're going room to room, you're fighting monsters, you're finding treasure, etc. And you and I played HeroQuest a little bit, I think the last time you were up here. And the problem with that is that, like, getting precisely four players is, in fact, a pain in the butt for any board game ever, I think, right? How often do you have exactly a specific number of players? Almost never. And so a very common rule that comes up, and I can't remember if it's in the rule book or not, it probably is, and if not, it's just by convention, is this idea that, like, the game is written for four characters. So if you have more or less than that, you should just do the percentage math, right? So if you have three players, you should get three quarters the number of monsters it tells you. If you have five players, you know, you should add another 20% monsters to your list. I've always used that when playing those games, and it works fine. I don't know.
Yeah. And that's what we see here. Now, again, this justification, like in the D&D campaign situation, I going to a prepared adventure, if I see this is what the lair is like, I always had a little bit of trouble of, like, why today are there less and why today are there more? I thought this was the situation on the ground.
Let's talk about the opposite approach, right? Because I've certainly seen, and there's a reason for saying, like, no, I want to say exactly how many monsters are here just based on the logic of the setting and the world, and this is how many monsters would be here.
Right.
And then the variable number of characters, it's up to them. And that also kind of makes an interesting challenge, right? Like, it is fun when you have a group of eight players and only three of them show up to the table and they say, oh, well, I guess we're going to be extra stealthy, right? We're going to change our tactics because there's only three of us.
Yes.
I think that's really interesting, right? Or the inverse of, like, let's go to town and hire a bunch of hirelings because more bodies will help.
Yeah.
Like, what happens if you're running an adventure like this that tells you to modify the number of monsters based on the number of characters, and the players immediately respond to that by saying, well, we go to town and we hire three more people to come with us. Are there now magically more monsters?
Yes. Yes. You're right. That, according to the original rules, the answer would be absolutely yes.
Why did we bother hiring people? What's the point?
Yes. Exactly. Right. When the play, right. And it seems like, see, that's a perfectly fine rule for a one-off game, for a convention, for a tournament, for a board game, for one night of, you know, we're adjusting the world that you're going into. But yeah, for a campaign that's supposed to have consistency, and let's say the players have already encountered this place. Let's say they've already gone in. Maybe they've done a scouting job. Maybe they've used a magic spell to find out what the situation is in this ogre lair. And then a week later, they come back and they happen to have more or fewer characters. And the whole situation is all different by a factor of 50%. They're going to discover that, right? At some point, they're going to discover that this is happening. And the ramifications of that are going to be very weird, I think, on exactly that point. So now let's talk a little bit. So let's say you take that off the table. Let's say you take off the idea of changing the numbers, and instead you rely on what you just said, Paul, about change the number of bodies, change the number of characters to the table. And so, interestingly, if you start looking, like, and this is the late 70s, like around 1980, if you look at the adventures coming out of TSR at the time, it seems like they started to rely on that more, and they stopped suggesting that the adventures didn't suggest to change the numbers at that time. And now they started to really rely on the henchmen and the hirelings that, again, that have also been baked into D&D from the start. That was kind of the whole point of the charisma ability. And if you look at the first introductory adventure, In Search of the Unknown by Mike Carr, that came with this Holmes basic set that I started with personally, I have that image up as with a yellow dot on it. So at the back of the table, at the back of the adventure, when in the section on setting up your player character party, you have this very specific table outlining how many henchmen are available in town based on how many player characters you're bringing in. And the table shows you, if you only have two actual player characters, then you've got 100% chance of getting between one and four henchmen. And then kind of higher up, If you have four player characters, there's only a 50% chance of maybe having one or two henchmen available. And notice that every single entry on this chart caps out at six, is the most bodies that you could possibly have. The expectation is going to be like around four or five. That's exactly the part, again, the party size that we kind of have become accustomed to for years and years, is that it's specifically the number of henchmen you can hire is kind of a range to get your party in the state of like four or five bodies on the present. So that's what this adventure was doing, with kind of an interesting explicit rule about that. Maybe that's a better way rather than changing what the situation in the monster lair is, possibly.
Now, certainly, I remember back in high school playing games where, again, I was playing with a group who definitely was not the most consistent. And there would be times, there was one other guy that I was in the group with who was super consistent. The two of us were always there. And then we had, I don't know, D6 other people show up, or maybe D6 minus one. There you go, right? So 0 to 5 other humans showed up to the game. And so sometimes it was just me and him. And then we would start to explore, like, well, what can we do with just the two of us? And we would go down this road often of like, well, I'll DM and you can run 3 or 4 characters. Okay. And we did that. Yeah, that was a pretty common thing for us to do. It was okay. We definitely both agreed. It wasn't as good. We're like, yeah, this is not as good as having more people at the table, but like better than wasting an afternoon when no one else bothered to show up.
Now, a question that I've done that in the past. In fact, in the last time we were talking about this, we saw the really interesting example of Tomb of Horrors that I think uniquely has a table for the number of players that showed up between, I think, 4 and 20, right?
Yeah.
Saying that if a small number show up, they should all get possibly up to 3 characters each. And actually specifically specifying in this list which characters they're going to be to bulk up the party. So a question that I had on this point, Paul, is if, and I think we've done this, I think, you know, when we were in our youth and crazy, we would do this without thinking about it. So if some players, if you have a standard group and some players don't show up, should you permit the characters of the absent players to be in the action?
Oh, geez, that's a whole other topic, and honestly, one that we've covered. So, kind of don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole. And I'll just mention, I bet, you know, maybe if one of our viewers is super on the ball, they can remind us which episode it is we talked about exactly this issue. I think it's less important which side of the fence on this argument you fall, and more important that you decide it up front and make it clear to everyone what the rule is.
That's a good point. It's a good point. Now, in your case, is that like, this is kind of what I'm asking right now. Is that what you were doing with your 2-person table? Were you using characters that were in the game already, or were you using a new or different?
Back then, of course, you know, I was a teenager. We didn't know what the heck we were doing, and we were trying a million different things all the time. Usually it was a separate, we had a tendency to trade off who was DMing, and we would run just separate adventures, separate campaigns all the time, and we would jump from thing to thing to thing to thing. So usually in those cases, it was like, all right, well, I'll grab this adventure and I'll run it. You pick a couple characters from your folder and we'll go. So maybe there was a character from a bigger campaign who was making a cameo in this one-off random adventure, and maybe not.
Nice. Yeah, nice. Now, I will say that when I did bring that issue up, some of our patrons and some of our viewers in the chat here had quick and clear and concise answers to whether you should permit other characters to be involved. For example, Steve K said nope.
I appreciate for a long time not that long ago where the rule was all characters are always present and a story, and you have to leave your character sheet behind. You can't take it home with you. It has to be here so that we have access to it when you're not here. Now, what we did in those cases is I didn't want to like completely take agency away from my players. So I gave them all a chronic disease. And I said, if the player is not present, the character has a flare up of that disease and they are almost completely out of it. And the rest of the party has to drag their sorry body along with them. So,
you know,
it was very funny, right? It was a Warhammer game, so that fit very well.
Yeah.
And it was nice because you saw the character sheet, so we knew, like, oh, they have this important piece of equipment. I go rifle his bag and get it. But you didn't have them casting spells or you know, fighting monsters or possibly dying, right? Unless it was like TPK kind of situation. If the players got themselves into a situation where they're like, ah, everybody's dead, whoops, then yeah, sorry, everybody died while you were out.
Okay, so interestingly, Paul, I have wound up doing exactly identically that in all circumstances, somewhat to my surprise in my current campaign. And it's just so fascinating that you just read back to me exactly what I'm doing. And I tend to resist this. And I think, as you know, like when playing a standard D&D, there's a big dungeon somewhere, I really make a concerted effort to avoid that issue by always having the play session start in town, go to the dungeon, and you've got to come right back at the end of story. And so,
I mean, that's an excellent point. Right? It kind of depends on, yeah, it kind of depends on where you're at and where you're leaving off. If you're playing like a mega dungeon, right, or just you're in the dungeon a lot, it makes sense that the characters would always be present. It feels weird to have them teleporting in and out. On the other hand, if you're recurringly returning to town, then it feels weird to be like, yeah, we drag this sick character along with us. Why would you do that? Leave them at home, right? We tuck them into bed and we say, you know, eat your soup and we'll see you later. So
what's happened in the current
100% of the time, unfortunately.
Right. And what's happened in the current campaign to prevent that technique that I normally do is I'm running the classic Star Frontiers science fiction campaign on the hostile alien abandoned world of Volturnus. And so it's mostly a wilderness adventure. They're traveling over large expanses of territory from different, you know, biomes to different biomes for potentially weeks or months of time. And it's not a situation where we can start a session, just say, you know, Alice was in town a couple of kilometers away and now they traveled over here. They've got to be traveling together, or it just wouldn't make any sense whatsoever. Yep. And so I didn't pre-plan this. I did not think about this in advance because it's not normally in my wheelhouse, but I absolutely, it's mostly a horrible desert planet largely. And so I absolutely have this, if the player's not here, the character has heat stroke. The character currently has heat stroke and they're traipsing along. They're semi-conscious. They're not active. Their gear is available. So if they've got medical gear and you need to grab it, they go do it. In the back of my head, exactly what you said, Paul, if the party gets TPK'd, I don't see any way around, you'd also lose those players. And I will say that once or twice, and I kind of feel a little dirty about it, once or twice I have had, they've never been involved in combat, but once or twice, if someone has a key skill to get through a particular, there's one character that had the ability to get through a lock. If there's one character that had the ability to cure a disease, I allow them to implement that. I feel a little dirty about it, but it's like that. They've been here specifically for that the entire time. And even campaign-wise, I didn't feel good about blocking the party as a result. So it's amazing, Paul, that once again, you and I have converged on the same solution to that, is that's exactly what I'm doing in my current campaign, much to my surprise.
It's a reasonable solution. Dan, I'm gonna call us here as like we're done with this rabbit hole. We're halfway through the show, and I want to get back to scaling content. So I think we've talked a lot about like just the mechanics of the number of monsters appearing, but I want to talk about some other stuff, some higher level meta stuff. When we get to challenges like interacting with NPCs, solving puzzles, other cases where or just making grandiose plans or whatnot. How do we deal with scaling the content to the number of humans at the table?
Well, that's interesting. What I mean, for me, I largely put it in the hands of the players about what they're going to do and sort of let the emergent thing happen. You mentioned that the players might show up and go, oh, we're going to treat this as a surveillance scouting mission. I've had that happen. I was very happy about that. Of the players are going to try to do more of a scouting situation and go next week. Hopefully, everybody else will be back and we can bring the big guns in, have our combat heavy characters back in play and actually take care of the situation. I personally really like that myself. I can't imagine that's going to work all the time.
Yeah, I do like that. I like that as well, especially for longer run campaigns where there's many irons in the pot in terms of like things to for the characters to do, right? Where so maybe the players are going to go, oh, we only have this subset of us. We'll come up with some excuse as to what's going on in the campaign world while the other characters are not available, and then have them redirect and like come up with different goals or different, you know, pursue yeah. different things. I think that's very interesting. So I do like bouncing that back to the players in those cases. We talk about the opposite ends of the spectrum, though. This comes up for me a lot, again, more in like one-shots or convention games where maybe you're more time limited, right? In cases where you're like, I have exactly 4 hours to run this game, and here's the content I have. We only have 3 players instead of 6 players, or we have 12 players instead of, you know, 6 players. How do we adapt that? I want to point out, I guess I want to get, what I'm trying to get at to is the example of, honestly, if you look at Fearful Ends, let me take that as an example. If you look at Fearful Ends, in the back of the book, in the appendix, there is an example adventure. And it's more what I would call a point crawl than a, you know, it takes place in a single location. You're in a mill, you're exploring room to room, but there's no map. The adventure very specifically says the mill is confusing, and, you know, it's a horror setting, right? So you're supposed to be like, consistently feel like we're lost in this labyrinthian structure, and it's crazy and weird to work our way around. But there are key locations. At some point, you're going to stumble on this room. At some point, you're going to stumble on that room. Here are their descriptions. And the way the text is laid out, it says, ultimately, this first location and this last location, those are the most important ones. Make sure you get to those. The other ones, sprinkle them in wherever you want. So like the content there is, what I was trying to do was allow for those different numbers of players or different amount of time, and give that GM a little more control over pacing to say, this room, not that important. We're just going to scoop it out. Or I'm going to put this room in, or I'm going to add this extra content because I don't want them to get to the final chamber and fight the boss monster just yet, because there's only 2 of them. They're racing through the adventure. I want to give them more. So I like content that's written that way, especially for stuff like horror or things that are not just straight up like dungeon crawl.
Yeah. I think that's advice that I needed that didn't exist in any of the early texts that I needed at years ago, frankly. I think that's good advice, but again, particularly for those like one-off event situations. And I myself am a little bit OCD, so if I have a map and I have a place, my instinct was always go through the literal thing in the script. That's what's in this. That's the text. So that's what's happening. And other DMs have better instincts about that than I have, frankly. And it's a good idea to have that on your toolkit.
Let's talk about an adventure that you and I are both, you know, well versed in, which is we both run several of the A series, right? Yeah. We've both run the A series. They're great, great modules. If you run the tournament content, it's very linear, right? It's just room, 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 room.
It is.
Right? With interesting stuff. And if you tried to map it out, it would be a little nonsensical, right? It doesn't really fit the structure of the place that you're supposedly exploring. I think that's a perfect example of, okay, granted, if you're really running it as a tournament and you're pointing it and you want to say like how many rooms they explore is part of their score, then absolutely don't do this. But if you're running this as a one-off for some friends, because you're like, oh, these people showed up and we're going to play this game and we have 4 hours to play, I see no reason not to scoop out some of the middle rooms. If you're looking at your watch and going, we've got an hour left, next room is the last big one. Go for it. Do it.
And again, I it's funny how I discover these things like in desperation on the fly. Particularly where that happened for me was the third adventure, the third out of the fourth. Had again kind of an intricate maze, and there was a point like about 3/4 the way in the underground area where there was this puzzly, trappy, you know, there's a bunch of corners and there's a kind of a labyrinth, and you get one crossbow shot from a sniper like about 10 times. And I got into that and I was like, here's a play. And I'm finally wise enough in my old years that it started, and I was like, this is going to suck. This is going to suck up a lot of time. No one's going to be happy about it. I'm not going to be happy about it. And most important of all, it's likely going to prevent us from having time in the climactic area. So that was a case where I actually did hand wave of, there's a labyrinth and you spend some time getting through it and maybe there's some shots here, take some damage, and now you're in the final area. So you're right, that's an element in those kinds of adventures that you need to think about. I've done that. I did that a little bit when, you know, full disclosure, when we had the good fortune of having the web DM people on the channel here running the Tomb of Rehotep adventure a couple of years back, actually, for Halloween. If you have that adventure and you look closely, you'll notice that I did skip a place kind of mid-adventure, and I should have done more.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I actually regretted that I didn't do it earlier and more, and that's a lesson I actually kind of took away from that for myself.
And again, I think it's fascinating as we dig into these topics, how often we uncover things like this, where I find like my thoughts are radically different for one-offs versus long-term campaign play, right? Long-term campaign play, you have time to do stuff. You should absolutely just let it unfold as it's going to unfold. That makes it exciting, makes it fun. It adds continuity, right? It feels good to be like, well, this is how far we got tonight. Go home. Yes. We'll come back to it. Whereas in a one-shot, like, you want that nice arc, right? You want to end in a satisfying way.
Yeah.
And we talk about this so much. Like, looking at the clock and saying, we got an hour and a half left. Let's get the exciting stuff up front. Make it happen.
They're so different. We talk about the difference in these contexts so much, and it winds up being part of our conversation practically every week. It's totally different game forms. And you really have to go into that being very, very cognizant, something I was not for many years. And I'll also say that I think this highlights a reason in your campaign game not to have an on-rails plot of if you planned out, you know, scenes A, B, C, D in your plot, in your campaign, you're going to have a big problem if you've set up plot point D and you just don't have the player bodies to properly interact with that. But if you have a campaign where there's a bunch of stuff, maybe it's a mega dungeon with a bunch of different levels and a bunch of different areas, some of which are more dangerous and some of which aren't, or a large campaign world that you've knit together of different possible options. And I will say that in the campaign that I'm currently running, I'm making a real goal for myself to always have at least three options in front of the players. So I start off every session, I go, remember, you could go to A, somebody told you about B, and there's also the rumor about C. Which one do you want to pursue today? And by having a bunch of threads like that in the world, that gives some flexibility for the players to choose whether they're going to a more dangerous place or a less dangerous place. And that kind of gives you a release valve there. But again, if you had a plot that was on rails, like you're a novelist, you have much more trouble with that. No.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree. I mean, there's another common edit I find myself doing that I want to toss out there, which is sometimes it'll happen that, you know, that the party reaches the climactic scene, whatever, the big thing, or a climactic scene. It doesn't even have to be the climactic scene, right? A climactic scene, something that feels like, this could be the end of the adventure. Something exciting happens. And let me be clear. I actually really don't like running games where, like, we have the big final fight with the big boss and everything becomes revealed and, like, you know, we deal with that and then stop playing and go home, right? Like, I do think you need a good, I don't know, 20 minutes of play after that to wrap things up and wind down and make it feel, you know, not rushed and not weird. I have certainly played games where we've hit that climactic scene and there is still a good chunk of time left, some amount of time left. And I find myself editing out some of the building stuff, right? This is especially true if you're in a dungeon with like a lot of interconnected tunnels and there's a lot of different ways to go, or a wilderness setting where there's a lot of different scenarios, right? If there are a lot of encounters that build up to that climactic scene that the group skipped, I don't want to bother with them with that stuff after they've done the climax, because it just feels weird, right? I have no problem cutting that stuff up. Yeah, those monsters fled. Once they heard the fatal death screams of the big boss, they're out of here. They're not going to hang around and wait for you to come back up and do cleanup. Because cleanup might be a little bit of fun for a short period of time, but like extended cleanup, it just gets tedious.
I tend to stick my players with the team. So for what it's worth, I tend to. So you said that would be weird, and I tend to embrace that point of weirdness. A narrative sour aftertaste. I'm willing to embrace, and I will say just to give our viewers options, just to give our viewers the yin yang. Right, feel free to listen to Paul, but I will say that in the two sessions ago in my campaign, there was a horrible month long wilderness trek with horrible monsters and horrible. You could get lost and then into a horrible crater and a cliff that could kill you. And then you're trapped in the crater and then an alien fungus. And you could also just things exploded randomly, get to the center, get to the spire, kill the giant bird, get the icon, right? End of session. Wonderful. It's super, super finish. And so I started the next session. I said, hey, players, some DMs would say that the story had been get into the horrible wilderness location, get the icon, and just hand wave you going back home. But I don't do that. And our story may possibly be you got into the dangerous location, actually got the thing, and then died on the way back. Let's find out if that's our story or not. And actually play out the whole get back terror journey. So there's your, and that was the whole session. It took a whole session to get back, frankly, because I didn't know. In reality, some people get, some people have historically gotten to the peak of Everest but not managed to return safely to camp. You could go either way with it. I actually do tend to have a climactic session and then you have to fight your way out of the dungeon. And yeah, I also get through the wandering monsters on the way back to town. And yes, Paul, I have had players actually call out in despair and say, oh, damn, when a wandering monster comes up on the way out. And I actually do, in fact, punish them with it because that's how it's going to roll. Anyway, viewers, there's option A and option B. And you can consider works best at your table.
Yeah, I hesitate to say something as strong as you're wrong, Dan. But what I will say is you should definitely run the thing that you're excited to run. If you think you can make it fun for the players, then that's what you should do. Absolutely. And if you think it's going to be boring for you, you should maybe cut that. Because if it's boring for you, it's probably going to be boring for your players.
That's a pretty good principle right there.
Okay, let me... I'm trying to cram everything in here before we run out of time. So here's another Wandering DM special on how to scale for players. And in this case, I want to talk about lots of players. What if there are 8, 10, 12 players? And I think one of the unique problems you see in those games is those cases of one person being in the limelight. Whether that's because they need to have a conversation with an NPC, they need to solve this particular puzzle that only one person can interact with, they need to use some specialized skill. Any situation where there's now going to be a lot of back and forth, they're going on a scouting trip, right? There's going to be a lot of back and forth between this one player and the DM, and now you've got 11 other people sitting at the table watching. Sometimes that's fun. Sometimes it's enjoyable for us to all spectate on the ridiculousness of the trouble that one person is getting in. And don't shy away from that, I will say. Definitely don't shy away from that. I actually super love that for like horror games where the party splits up. I love the party splitting up because I love to jump back and forth between the groups and so that everybody can watch a little bit of what the other group is getting into and laugh and enjoy their follies. But here's the Wandering DM special on how to deal with the limelight is on one player for an extended period of time. And the answer is, add another DM.
Oh, I think I just got attacked.
we've done it plenty of times, right, Dan?
We have
and,
yeah,
and I think that's one of the really one of the fun moments of a co-DM'd game is a one player says, I need to have a conversation with this NPC, I need to go on this scouting trip, I need to do this thing alone. I say, great, Dan, go take that guy into the kitchen and deal with it. I'm gonna play with the rest of the group. And we did that the last time we co-DM'd a game. I think that happened a couple of times.
It did.
It's delightful.
It did. And among the things that's really nice about that, it's actually you get that you wind up getting this telephone, this real telephone tag play of you come back, right? And the I don't know, player group A is like, yeah, things look pretty well. And player B comes in, they're ashen faced. And they're like, I don't know how to tell you guys this. And nobody else can hear. And they have to like relate. And then the other players are like, was this real? Can I trust them? Were they mind controlled? Was it an illusion? And then there's this really interesting murky mirror moment about like what combining the two different threads of information. It works out. It's a really great moment. That's again, it's not in any book, but boy, that's a great moment right there.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoy that a lot.
Yeah. I will call out, right, original D&D, right, in that section where it said your campaign could have anywhere from between 4 and 50 players. It was very specific to say the player to DM ratio should be about 1 to 20. So if you get up to 40 players, then yes, I guess at that point you should have two DMs according to original D&D.
Dan, there's a style of play I think that the OD&D is hinting at here that I have one anecdote of where I did this that I suspect this is what OD&D is getting at. I had a group of players. They're exploring a dungeon. They come across a magic glyph. They touch it. The first person touches it, they disappear. And then the party goes, oh no, now we have a terrible decision to make. Do we follow them and hope that it's a teleporter and not like a death ray? Or do we just say, well, sorry, sucker, see you never? And they decide that they're gonna follow. So one by one, they go up and they touch the glyph. Poof, poof, poof. Each person disappears. The last player gets there and goes, "I'm not touching that. Hell no." And I said, "Great, great. We're just gonna put your character on ice for a minute. We'll deal with you later. I'm gonna jump to the main group because I want to deal with the five players who did touch the thing and not you. But we're gonna accept the fact that your characters decided not to touch the glyph." Went back to the main group. Sure enough, they had teleported to a different location. I ran the game a little bit with them, and then we got to the end of our session. This was an ongoing campaign. So we got to the end of the session, and then I turned to the guy who got left behind, and I said, "Let's schedule a time for you and I to sit down and talk about what happens to your character before the next session with the main group." And we did that, and we ran a quick solo one-on-one game in midweek. And it was wonderful that we were able to do this. The next time the group gets back together, everyone's at the table, that player's there. He's got a brand new character, and I tell him he's not allowed to talk about what happened to his previous character. And it was delightful. And he was in, I think he enjoyed it too. He was in on the joke. He knew his character had befallen a terrible fate. Eventually, the party did stumble on the thing that killed him, and he had to keep his mouth shut because his new character didn't know what it was. And it was just absolutely wonderful. Loved it.
That's great. I think you're probably right. I think we hear stories about, you know, Gary and Dave having sessions kind of like that of, you know, Gary having round the week, every night sessions, and whoever drops in plays. You know, we had Rob Kuntz as co-DM for Greyhawk for a while. And also, at least at some early point, some players, I think they might have been in the army at that point, were calling up Dave Arneson on the telephone nights. Like, I need my character be involved in Blackmoor. So please, you know, tell me, I'm going to call you, Dave, for a couple hours on Tuesday. We're going to chat through what my character is doing in the world of Blackmoor. So I think there's
if
pretty good precedent.
If your schedule allows it, I think that's a fun way to get some of that same effect. If you don't have two DMs, you can get that right by just slicing your time up. If your schedule allows it, it doesn't always work out that way, but it is super fun. It's super fun.
And now you can zoom. You can use a virtual tabletop for an hour or two if someone's distant like that.
You might have a recurring weekly or bi-weekly game where everyone shows up in person, but why not throw a Zoom in between for like, I'm going to deal with this little thing on the side.
Yeah.
I want to share, I'm probably shared this anecdote with this channel before, but I'm just going to share the punchline to that whole thing is that my delightful, horrible, you know, critical injury role that had happened to this guy. He was fighting evil pixies, and they severed his face, according to the chart. Severed face is what killed him. And so sure enough, the players, when they find the area with the evil pixies, there's his old character telling him, "Hey, come on, come join us. We're having a great time." And of course, that is an evil pixie wearing the severed face, which was just
classic.
Just perfect.
Classic. Perfect. face-off action.
It was great. It was great because there's this meta joke happening at the table, right? Because they all know, well, there's his player, and his player has got a different character. So who the hell is this? Like, no, that's fine. I'm okay with that kind of murky mirror stuff happening where they're like, yeah, there's something wrong. There's something not right about it. It's the person you remember. It looks like him, but something's not right here. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Nice.
Any other thoughts, Dan, on ways to scale up? What do you do when you have like, oh gosh, I was planning for six players and I have 10?
Well, okay, so having been surprised by a new player a week or two ago, what came to mind was, one, I do tend to start triggering the caller position when the playgroup gets like six or more generally. So I've got that in the back of my head. If it gets really large, I may indicate, and I think I would, in a campaign, I think I would want to certainly pick one of the regulars, right? Make sure that one of the regulars is the caller. I think there's a bit of a danger, and I've seen this, I've succumbed to this. There's a bit of a danger. You like to have a friendly open table. If a brand new person comes in and they're kind of not tied into the existing idiom of like what the gameplay is like, they might possibly throw things off. You might have someone come in and go, I'm going to be the thief. I'm going to steal from people. I'm going to backstab people.
Yeah.
When that's really not part of the play normally. So kind of be cautious about that. Maybe have a caller leader type who's one of your regular people to kind of show the way might be a way of managing that. And the other thing is, you don't want to spend time doing a whole session zero to introduce the new people. You want to get the action playing and not bore everybody else. So that's a case where maybe having some pre-gens to pick from, or possibly contacting the player in advance and making a pre-generated for them to get started with.
You're actually reminding me of
those are things I was dealing with.
Yeah, you're reminding me of a thing that I did in a campaign that's kind of the opposite of, hey, you know, we have too few players, so to double up, you know, play an extra character. In this campaign I was running, we had a beloved henchman that the players had hired who was a fighter that when we rolled him up, he had 18 strength. And so we decided that he was like classic Conan-esque barbarian, big dumb warrior who just solved everything with his fists. And he was a beloved henchman, survived longer than many of the player characters. And he became the standard loner character. If we had a friend in from town, somebody wanted to join in at the table for a session, said, great, you're playing the barbarian. And the lovely thing was he was such a stereotype. It was very easy for anyone brand new to sink their teeth into.
Great.
Big dumb barbarian. Go. He takes big risks. He has huge muscles. Go. And like they all just got it right away. Always got it. People loved coming in as guest starring so-and-so as, I can't remember what his name was, something stupid, right? Blood Axe the Barbarian, something ridiculous. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so works, consider that, right? Especially if you're already playing with henchmen. Consider having extra players guest star as the henchmen.
Right. That's good. Yeah. That's good. Yep. And look, you know, I will confess, I'll say before we wrap up, I will confess that what I've been doing lately in my game, even in my campaign games, is that I actually have been kind of taking the Holmes advice, you know, in the back of my head, lo these many years ago, is I actually do scale the wandering monsters to how many players I have. Not the set encounters, not the set layers, outpost establishments. That's up to the players to deal with cleverly. But I actually have found myself modifying the wandering monster numbers. And maybe Holmes is correct. Maybe smaller numbers are more surreptitious and get by the monsters. And at least that avoids completely overwhelming the players with a large number of wandering monsters. And the places that they go to and they can know about and they can find out in advance, then it's on them to deal with the possibly large numbers or maybe come back another week. And that actually is how I've been handling that for the wandering monster issue lately myself. Don't tell my players.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I have no problem with the scaling up the numbers of monsters. It's definitely something that is always in the back of my head when I'm playing the game. And yeah, there's a balance there. I feel like there's a sometimes, And maybe it's just a situational thing that you need to evaluate. Sometimes it makes sense to shrink or grow the number of monsters just to make for a more exciting encounter. And sometimes it's more interesting to say, well, the numbers are what the numbers are. And the challenge to the players in turn is to figure out how to deal with that based on their variable size of their party. I don't know.
Now, I will say that
you can't draw a line in the sand and say, always do this and always do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say I'm not fond of modifying it on the fly. So I think we've seen some DMs, like they start a fight and then the DM didn't make a good decision about it in advance. And then they decide on the fly, like, these are very scared monsters, and they all run away, or a different group of monsters just comes out of nowhere to fend them off or something like that. And to me, that kind of has a bad smell to it, and it always looks like that, like something was a mistake. So I would recommend you think about it a little bit in advance. Come up with a policy in advance for how you're going to do that, and not literally try to correct in the middle of an encounter, because I've never seen that work super well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, right? If they're too few and they're just trounced, it just let them have an easy fight, then up the numbers on the next one.
Yeah,
right?
Or yeah, agreed. Yes,
they're having right. too hard of a fight. I don't know. Let them get in over their heads. Maybe it's TPK time. Sometimes TPK is the way players learn to play the game.
Sometimes that has to be the path to better play.
I also do like occasionally morale. Yeah, I use morale. Sometimes it does. So I've definitely had fights where the players thought that they were like, oh, geez, we're doing okay, but there's just so many of them. I don't know if we're going to survive. And then morale breaks and they run off and holy cow, saved by the morale rules. So,
yeah, I think that's really necessary for old school gaming. In my Book of War Wargaming, it's the most important thing. The morale is literally the most important thing in the game. And I'll say, like, in my Star Frontiers game, I'm kind of taking a lesson from our friend Keith Amon, who does Monsters Know How They're Doing, is, you know, frankly, when a monster gets below half, they take off. It's pretty simple. Yeah. In Star Frontiers, there's even a rule that your combat abilities are massively degraded when you get below half. So as long as I don't forget, monsters take off when they're below half, and that works pretty well, honestly. It seems honest. It seems real world to me.
I think the message here is not don't use it, but just don't use it as a crutch.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't make it up on the fly. Have a plan in advance. But yeah, morale is a really key aspect to both. Again, it hits both buttons of it's both realistic and it makes for good gameplay. So it should be part of yours.
And we're definitely over time here. Any final thoughts on scaling adventures for different party sizes?
I think it's a great point to distinguish between your one-off games and your campaign play. And for your one-off games, scaling the encounters, scaling the number of characters, cutting bits of the event, great, great, great ideas. And for a campaign, maybe different techniques. Maybe scale wandering monsters like I do, give the players options of different places to go, put it in the player's lap about how they're going to approach the thing with more or less bodies. And I think there's a lot of good tools you have for both of those very different circumstances.
The one thing I think we didn't quite get to, which I'm disappointed about, is adventure writing. Like if you are, whether you're publishing a module or you're just creating one for use by your campaign. So I'm not going to get into specific advice for that, but just say, think about it, right? Consider how the module should change for the extremes of the party size and contemplate whether or not
Great.
You need some text Great. into your module for helping the DM navigate that problem.
Great. And you know what? I'll just put up one item from the chat. A couple minutes ago, Josh said, lately, we've just been postponing the session. So maybe if you get way, way, way down in players, we've done that. When I get down to two players, yeah, we play a card game. That's part of it, too. Very smart.
Yeah, sure. I think you can make that call on the fly. I've definitely had sessions like that where only two people of the larger group show up and I say, well, what do you want to do? We could wing an adventure. We could have a little side adventure for your two characters. Or, you know, we could play a board game. What do you feel up to?
Yep. My very words from last Friday, Paul.
Yeah. Viewers, if you have thoughts on how to scale your adventures up or down for more players or fewer players than you were anticipating, let us know. Put your thoughts here in the comments section. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe that will fuel a new discussion for us down the road.
Yeah, and of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub by the handle Wandering DMs. So look for us on those sites, and please blow up that like button!
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format and not read Dan's tiny text, you can do so. Those podcasts are available at our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various podcast carriers such as Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher. If you're listening to this podcast right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show and are very polite and don't give me any crap at all. And if you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And you're going to get access to our Discord server, just like Paul said at the top of the show. And we're talking 24/7 there with lots of great ideas and discussions about old school D&D and new D&D and science fiction games and miniatures and all kinds of great stuff like that. So we will look forward to having you there on the after chat, if you can make it, in about 10 minutes, a part of the week that we always enjoy. So if you're not there, get on Patreon. Get on the $1 tier, and we would love to have you join us maybe for another time or for the first time today here on the after chat on Discord. And don't forget, of course, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.